Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. What the digital economy giveth, the digital economy can taketh away too, you know. You have to know what you're doing out there, people. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 20th of November. Good as always to have you here, everybody. We begin today with something that everyone is definitely not in the loop about: how to prosper in this digital economy. We told you yesterday about Home Depot and its third quarter woes, you remember. Lousy sales and lowered full year projections, in part because its online strategy isn't paying off. Today, its Target, BAFO, would be a good description of its profit report today. Everything up more than anybody had been guessing. Digital sales, in particular, up 31% over a year ago. A lot of reasons for all of this, of course. The retailer has been pushing tariff costs onto its suppliers, for one thing, but also its online sales strategy, which, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, might not actually be all that online at all.
A few years ago, Target began investing in new ways for customers to buy things.
Buy online, pick up in store. Buy online, have delivered to your house. Same day, next day, second day.
Charlie O'Shea is a senior retail analyst with Moody's. Consumers liked this, especially curbside pickup, where you drive up and someone from the store drops your stuff in your trunk and then you drive off. Andrew Lipsman is a retail analyst with eMarketer.
It fits into their schedule, driving home from work. They save on shipping costs. Another key driver is really concerns around package theft.
He says curbside pickup accounted for 80% of the surge in digital sales. Target was able to save money on shipping, too. It uses its own stores as distribution centers for local delivery. Target's CEO told CNBC that, in curbside pickup, cut costs by 90%. Greg Portell is with A.T. Kearney.
They are bringing together digital and physical in ways that many other retailers haven't been able to successfully do.
The stuff that Target stores carry is also often tailored to local markets, says Moody's Charlie O'Shea.
They're able to just laser in on the local market and what those folks are going to buy. And then they've set the back rooms up so that they're able to do that.
Now, of course, the big driver behind all these efforts to make it easier for consumers to buy things is that consumers are willing to buy things. As long as that holds up, so will Target's fortunes. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, consumers and the health of this economy, over at the Federal Reserve, everybody is in the loop about interest rates. The minutes of the Fed's most recent meeting were announced today. And unless the data gets worse, ain't no more interest rates coming for a while, gang. On Wall Street this Wednesday, things took a turn lower on speculation a trade deal with China might not get done this year. Of course, that could all change tomorrow. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amazon is, well, it's everything, right? It's big. It's connected. Think of their cloud services business. It's a go-to for tens of millions of consumers in this economy. And it's also, it turns out, something of a CEO factory for American startups. Dana Mattioli wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal today. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What has put Amazon in the company of, like, you know, companies like GE, which used to breed, you know, CEOs of other companies like it was going out of style?
Yeah, so Amazon has sort of stolen that CEO factory title from General Electric. And people who have gone through Amazon's program have come out and founded or ran giant companies. We're talking like Hulu, WeWork's interim CEOs from Amazon, Tableau Software, Zulily, the list goes on.
Do you think this is real? I mean, would these people have gotten, you know, these jobs or had their success even if they were at, you know, the Acme Widget Company?
That's a great question. Is it the chicken or the egg?
Right,
is Amazon hiring great people that would have been CEOs independently of that, or are they grooming them? And I think it's probably a mix of both. They have a very rigorous and different sort of hiring process than other places that is meant to weed out, you know, weaker candidates. That could be part of it. But these are probably, there's a level of self-selection here. If you're applying to a job at Amazon, you probably have a lot of these skills that are embodied there.
Let us detour here for a moment to Jeff Bezos, who long ago put into place these leadership principles. I think there are 14 of them that, as you say in this article, a lot of these executives have taken with them.
That's right. So there's 14 well-defined leadership principles at Amazon. And the way this story sort of came about is when I was speaking to people who had since left Amazon, even years ago, they would talk about randomly bringing up these leadership principles in conversation at their new companies, even though that was not the leadership principle there, even with their kids. These are so ingrained in executives at Amazon that it becomes part of their vernacular outside of the office.
The big one, of course, is every day is day one in Amazon, right? Every day, we got to prove ourselves every day. We're a startup. Go, go, go.
Yeah, that's a very common saying from Jeff Bezos. It's not one of the leadership principles, but it's something that comes up in every shareholder letter and all hands meetings.
So it's a leadership principle with an asterisk or something. All right. So, but look, there's another part of this, right? And it's that Amazon is known as a really hard place to work. I have an acquaintance who was there and is no longer. Part of that is you know, certainly personal choice. But part of it also is that it can be tough in Amazon culture-wise.
That's correct. A lot of the CEOs I spoke to from this story said that they learned a lot at Amazon and it did set them up to become leaders elsewhere. And they've sort of cherry-picked what they want to bring with them in their new capacity. So they're bringing along things like strong leadership principles and ways of doing business from Amazon. But some of them are saying, you know, they're striving for a more empathetic culture than they might have found there.
Dana Mattioli covers Amazon for The Wall Street Journal. Dana, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
What with Thanksgiving being next week, this seems as good a time as any to talk about the business of food, specifically America's Test Kitchen, the multi-decades-old food media enterprise that includes America's Test Kitchen, the PBS show, Cook's Illustrated Magazine, Cook's Country, the PBS show and magazine, a podcast, a ton of cookbooks, a subscription-based website, online cooking classes, a cooking club for kids. You get the idea. The guy running all of that is America's Test Kitchen CEO, David Nussbaum. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Chairman of the board and CEO of America's Test Kitchen, you may be. We should say at the outset, you're not really a cook, though, right?
I am very much of an amateur, and I became that when I joined the company.
In the company of professionals. So what do you do? How do you, as the guy running the enterprise, maintain the voice for which America's Test Kitchen is so well known?
Well, you know, my job really is to build a strategy that helps us move to more platforms, to reach more people, to reach new geographies, to help our people identify trends, and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, make the business bigger and more profitable.
What are your new platforms? I mean, probably people know you best for the television show, the magazine, of course, Cook's Illustrated, which, full disclosure, we were once upon a time subscribers to in my house.
Thank you.
Where else are you going?
A lot of places, actually. First of all, we have a digital website that is subscription only, and it's one of the largest, I think, in the country outside of kind of the big newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 420,000 subscribers to that website. It's gated, so unlike most websites, you cannot get any information free.
Well, all right. So hang on right there for a minute, because I can go online and get a recipe for pretty much everything and not have to pay anybody a dime.
That's right. But what you will not get is the America's Test Kitchen touch. And what that is that we test every recipe between 40 and 60 times. We spend an average of $10,000 on every recipe.
That,
so when you
are
use
you kidding
when you use
me?
Our recipe,
$10,000?
$10,000 per recipe, and sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less, but that's the average. So when you use our recipe, and if you follow it carefully, the food will be perfect and the presentation will be magnificent, and no one else can make that claim.
Okay. All of which, yes, fine, and I appreciate the rigor that you bring, but isn't cooking a little bit of the, hey, let's try some of this and see what happens, as opposed to you must put 14 grams of flour and then 2 grams of sugar or whatever it is?
Well, it depends. Do you want a meal that's really, 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 really good and has been tested by pros, or do you want to kind of take a shot and hope that it comes out well?
I can't go too much farther in this interview without acknowledging the 800-pound bow-tied gorilla in the room, Chris Kimball, who we have recently had on this program. And I don't want to get into the back and forth that y'all have had, but I do want to point out that the icon of this company departed, and it does not seem to have hurt the business model at all. You guys are doing all right.
Well, the ratings of the two TV shows have grown. The revenue of the business has grown. The profits have grown. We've moved into new markets like podcasts. So we wish him well, but the company rocks on. You know, the strength of the TV shows has always been really the ensemble. It's not one person. Mm-hmm. And so he did leave, but we have, you know, really superstars like Bridget and Julia and Jack and Adam. So we're doing quite fine ourselves.
Why did you take this job?
Huh, that's a really good question. You know, my history is that I've run companies backed by private equity.
Yeah.
And what that means is that I've been hired to come into a company. Generally, it's a company that is highly levered, and my job was to build the company and sell it. That's a really hard job.
Mm.
You know, you're constantly for sale. Your staff knows that. And I decided back in 2015 when I sold my last company that I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I want to find a place that could be a home that's privately held, that we invest in the business and don't think about the next quarter. And I looked around and America's Test Kitchen was the very best of them.
I started with a cooking question. I will end with a cooking question. And it goes like this. How much of what you do at America's Test Kitchen is responding to how we're cooking now versus leading us, if you will, guiding us to cook in a certain way?
But it's really a combination, because one of the other, you know, special attributes of our recipes that I should have mentioned earlier is that we have a group of about 35,000 people who have volunteered to test our recipes. So the process of how our recipes evolve is partially our chefs and our cooks and our editors, and partially the input of our fans and people who are actually in their home kitchens cooking.
David Nussbaum is the chairman and the CEO, definitely not the head chef at America's Test Kitchen. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've got more of my conversation with David Nussbaum for subscribers of our Corner Office podcast, which is, by the by, totally free, available wherever fine podcasts are distributed. Coming up.
I've done some paintings in Fiji and Hawaii.
Not a bad side hustle, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 112 today, 0.4%, 27,821. The NASDAQ down 43 points, about a 0.5%, 85.26. The S&P 500 slumped 11 points, 0.3%, 31.08. We talked about Target's strong quarterly report, zipped up 14% did Target shares. But the retail apparel news is kind of mixed. Urban Outfitters, that also owns the Anthropologie brand, dressed down more than 15% today after its report missed the mark. In the home improvement retail space, since we were talking about Home Depot a little bit, Lowe's rose 3.9% today. Home Depot, though, down another 2.1% on the day today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.74%. And you're listening to Marketplace. On Corner Office, you're going to hear stuff you're not going to hear anyplace else. Travel tips from Arnie Sorensen of Marriott.
Always be on local time. Always get natural light. Always exercise.
This from YouTube's Susan Wojcicki.
It's great to see the impact that we can have and the responsibility that comes with that.
And Microsoft's Satya Nadella on why it's personal.
I mean, he's in a hospital bed managed with devices and software that we built.
Listen to my conversations with them and more on the Corner Office podcast.
Want to dive deeper into a story you hear on Marketplace? Visit our website at marketplace.org for extra content and analysis. From videos to explainers, we have you covered when it comes to understanding the economy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A story now about beer. Sadly, not really about actual beer, but a beer company, more like. One of the big names in craft brewing, New Belgium, out of Colorado, maker, among others, of Fat Tire Ale, is selling to a subsidiary of the Japanese beer maker Kirin, thus bringing to an end one of the better-known examples of an employee-owned company. New Belgium switched to all employee ownership in 2012 through something called an employee stock ownership plan. Only about 6,000 or so companies in this economy are set up that way. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has the primer.
The number of employee-owned companies like New Belgium has dipped slightly over the last decade or so, but there are actually more workers in the ones that are left, according to Lauren Rogers with the National Center for Employee Ownership.
Employee-owned companies tend to be just more productive, so they grow faster, they increase their own employment faster than the average business.
Research shows there's less turnover, too.
I've been with the company for 33 years.
Sandra Reed is an executive at the Davy Tree Expert Company, which specializes in yard care and is one of the largest employee-owned companies in the country with about 11,000 employees.
Employee ownership is definitely one of the reasons that, keeps me with the Davy organization. We work for ourselves and we work for each other.
While entirely employee-owned companies like Davy or New Belgium are rare, almost half of private sector companies give workers some kind of stake in a business through stock options or profit sharing, says Joseph Blasi, a professor at Rutgers University. He says these kinds of plans can help reduce growing income inequality.
Having a chance to own some shares in your company or share in the profits, that's a way for financial inclusion and fairness.
Blasi says all the benefits to productivity and retention can sometimes make these companies a victim of their own success. Employees want to cash out when business is good, and if they sell, that's one less company owned by its workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There are, for those who are counting, 14 games in the National Football League, something like 50 NCAA games, and who knows how many high school and youth games this coming weekend and in the coming week. And nearly half of the people watching those games will be women. On the sidelines, though, and in the league and team offices, not quite so many, by which I mean not even close to as many women. Sam Rappaport is trying to change that. She is the Senior Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the National Football League. Sam, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
This is going to sound like a kind of a fundamental question, but why does the NFL want more women in football? What's the business case?
The business case really is to ensure that we're considering the entire talent pool when we are staffing our football operations positions and our business operations positions. And so previously, you know, women felt disenfranchised from some of these positions, and we're trying to build a bridge and connect them to people that could put them in a position to hire them.
Football is not without its challenges now, most specifically the idea of, physical wellness of these players. How do you justify getting more people in to support and continue that system?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most popular sport in the country. There's no reason why the entire population shouldn't get involved if they so desire. And so, you know, me personally growing up, I was obsessed with football. I never missed a game. I always knew I wanted to work in the NFL. And so I want to make sure that if there are other young girls or people of color, people who are new to this country that have an interest in football, that they believe it's for them as well.
With all respect, Sam, you didn't answer the question, right? Because it's a tough time for football.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as far as it being a tough time for football, I think that people love the game. They still want to be involved in it. They still watch it. You know, we have thousands of women who have contacted us for our programs that want to get involved. And so we want to make sure that they can be.
What's your marker for success? Do you want 50% female head coaches? Is that where you're going?
No, our overall mission is to normalize women in football. Yeah. So what we want is for us to stop talking about the fact that that coach is female or that scout is a female, and we just want it to normalize. And so, you know, we're not putting any markers on the first female this or that. We really want to flood the pipeline with as many girls and women who want to work in football and creating representation for young girls coming up.
How did you get yourself to the NFL? I mean, we were talking before we turned the microphones on. You're Canadian. You've played some flag football up there and some other kinds of stuff. How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I was a girl growing up that was obsessed with the sport, played it at a young age. In Canada, girls flag and touch football is ubiquitous. It was an easy entry into the sport. And same goes for Mexico, but in the United States, that wasn't the case. And, you know, my father asked me at one point in high school what I wanted to do. And I mentioned the only thing I want to do is work in football. And so when I was in college, I applied for an internship at the NFL. And I knew I had to stand out. I had no connections. I didn't know anyone that worked in the industry. And I sent a picture of me in my full tackle football uniform. I was a quarterback. And I sent a football with my resume. And on the football, I wrote, "What other quarterback could accurately deliver a pass 386 miles, which was the distance between Montreal, where I went to school, and New York. And so, you know, it stood out. It was gimmicky, but, you know, I knew that I had to do something to show how badly I wanted it, and it worked, and I got my first internship in 2003.
Yeah, good for you. That's a great lesson. But look, let me ask you sort of a corollary question, right? For football players, the overwhelming majority of whom are male as they proceed through the high school and college and professional ranks, they get into the youth pipeline early, right? They start playing, they move up, they get bigger, stronger, faster. Is it attractive to a teenage girl to be the team manager for the high school football team and move up that way? How do you sell that?
Yeah, Kai, you just identified the number one barrier that women have to entry into football, which is boys grow up in it and girls don't.
Right, right.
And so what we're trying to do is create opportunities, you know, at the youth and high school level where they can learn the skill set that they need to develop on. And we've seen a couple instances of high schools that have brought on equal number of women to men or have started to bring on more women. So that trend is something that we're proud of.
Sam Rappaport, she's the Senior Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the National Football League. Sam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Ski resorts are going to start opening in the next couple of weeks, and if you're a skier, or maybe probably even if you're not, there's a good chance you've used or at least seen a trail map. Which run goes where, how hard they are, and which lift you need to take to get to where you need to go. They're often pretty detailed, these maps, sometimes quite artistic, and they don't paint themselves, you know. My Economy is our series about people out there making a go of it.
I'm James Niehuis. I'm from Parker, Colorado, and I paint ski maps. I was a freelance graphic designer in Denver and was looking for jobs and decided to check in on Bill Brown, the previous trail map illustrator, and walked in looking for maybe some extra work and walked out with a career. I've painted around 200 different ski resorts around the world, a total of probably near 400 individual paintings. You know, sometimes I'll do an inset for a couple of $1,000s, and the large ski area today around 15,000 to produce that. They then have the full rights to use that image for as long as they want for any purpose they want. In fact, the very first trail map that I ever produced, which was Boreo, California, is still in use, and that's 30 years later. The ski industry is a pretty small industry to support more than a few artists to do the trail maps. You don't always have a steady flow of ski maps to paint. Some years, 10 of them will decide to have a new trail map, and then I'm very busy. And other years, it may be down to two or three, and I'm looking for other avenues of income. So because of that, I've done quite a few summer versions. I've done some paintings in Fiji and Hawaii and national parks. There are very lean years in this business, and I think that's a lot of the reason why, I don't have a lot of competition is because it is such a small market. Well, right now I'm trying to be semi-retired, but I find that I'm busier than ever. I've got a pretty full slate this year. I have a protege that is coming along, so he's doing a few now and then. But be frank with you, you know, I get a good project in and I just don't pass it on to him. I have to take it myself.
James Niehuis there. His book, The Man Behind the Maps, is out now. Can't do this series without your help. I know I say this all the time, but it's true. There is a spot at marketplace.org where you can send us stories of your economy. This final note on the way out today from the What Could Possibly Go Wrong department. Uber, reports the Washington Post, is going to start recording its rides. Audio only, and so far just a pilot program in Latin America. Testing in the United States at a date still TBD. You get the safety benefits, obviously, but still. Oh, look, time's up. Dow Industrial is down 112 today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 43 points, that's about 0.5%. The S&P 500 tumbled 11 points, 0.3%. No, 0.3% is not really a tumble, I get that. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.